This is Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz, and this is KBOO Portland.
Say what's up to everybody. Davey D hanging out with you. And it is good to have somewhat of a voice back. I've been without a voice for almost a full week, but it's back. And we're here. And we're here to talk this afternoon and share some thoughts. A riveting speech from a friend, a freedom fighter, an artist, an organizer, somebody who is no joke. Her name is Patrice Cullors. You may know that name because she is the co-founder of Black Lives Matter and is recently been getting a lot of attention because her and another friend, Asha Bendeli, have written a book. And the book is incredible. Let me just get the title because I always mess up the title of When They Call You a Terrorist. I read that book and... You know, I was riveted to just on the edge of my seat. And it's not an entertaining book in that sense. You know, I don't want to, you know, it's not like a spy thriller. But it was riveting because how real they were able to describe what it was like coming up in Los Angeles and Van Nuys during the 1980s. The types of abuse that citizens... who are black or brown routinely have to deal with, that often doesn't get reported. I mean, we hear about the shooting death of unarmed individuals in our community, but what's never really talked about is the day-to-day harassment, brutality, humiliations, disrespect that people encounter when they live in these areas. You know, once I think it was Bobby Seale or maybe Huey Newton of the Black Panthers talked about the police being an occupying army. And you really get that picture in reading this book, When They Call You a Terrorist. And from that, those descriptions and those challenges that are described in growing up to see Patrice, you know, rise up and become this fierce organizer, you know, first organizing against the sheriff. After seeing her brother brutalized and then calling for police accountability throughout Southern Cali. And then, of course, you know, being a key anchor in BLM, Black Lives Matter, is inspiring. And it's much needed reading and analysis for a new generation of folks to kind of understand what the current terrain is. And so it was good to talk to her, and it was good that she came to the Bay Area and she spoke. She spoke at the First Congregational Church in Oakland. Our very own Kat Brooks, who's no joke herself, shared the dais, and they got busy. And so with that being said, I want us to listen to Patrice Cullors, who has been on our show above and beyond this speech and above and beyond the fund drive. But this afternoon, we want to share her incredible remarks in a conversation she had with Kat Brooks at the First Congregational Church in Oakland. So without further ado, let us turn the mic over to Patrice and Kat Brooks, and we'll be right back on Hard Knock Radio.
I'm very, very grateful for the warm welcome to the Bay Area. Feel super humbled to hold space tonight for Black people. What we've been through, what we've survived, how we've survived and the brilliant and innovative and creative movement of this moment. And it's a deep and profound honor to be able to have been on a 2-week tour, and this is the last stop. So I want to read a bit for y'all from this beautiful, beautiful book, and then we'll sit and chat it up with my sister Kat. We are stardust. I write to keep in contact with our ancestors and to spread truth to people. Sonia Sanchez. Days after the election of 2016, Asha sent me a link to a talk by astrophysicist Neil deGrasse Tyson. We have to have hope, she says to me across 3,000 miles. She in Brooklyn, me in Los Angeles. We listen together as Dr. deGrasse Tyson explains that the very atoms and molecules in our bodies are traceable to the crucibles and centers of stars that once upon a time exploded into gas clouds. And those gas clouds formed other stars, and those stars possess the divine right mix of properties needed to create not only planets, including our own, but also people, including us, me and her. He is saying that not only are we in the universe, but that the universe is in us. He is saying that we, human beings, are literally made out of stardust. And I know when I hear this, and I know when I hear him say this, that he is telling the truth because I have seen it since I was a child. The magic, the stardust we are, and the lives of the people I come from. I watched it in the labor of my mother, a Jehovah's Witness, and a woman who worked 2 and sometimes 3 jobs at a time, keeping other people's children, working the reception desks at gyms, telemarketing, doing anything and everything for 16 hours a day, the whole of my childhood in the Van Nuys barrio where we lived. My mother, cacao brown and smooth, disowned by her family for the children she had as a very young and unmarried woman. My mother never giving up despite never making a living wage. I saw it in the thin brown face of my father, a boy out of Cajun country, a wounded healer whose addictions were born of a world that did not love him and told him so not once but constantly. My father who always came back, who never stopped trying to be a better version of himself, there were no mirrors for. And I knew it because I am the 13th generation progeny of a people who survived the holes of slave ships, survived the chains, the whips, the months laying in their own and the human beings legislated as not human beings who watched their names, their languages, their goddesses and gods, the arc of their dances and beats of their songs, the majesty of their dreams, their very family snatched up and stolen, disassembled and discarded, and despite this built language and honored God and created movement and upheld love. What could they be but stardust, these people who refuse to die, who refuse to accept the idea that their lives did not matter, that their children's lives did not matter. Ashe.
God, there's so many good places to start. But I think I just want to start with the title of the book, When They Call You a Terrorist. When was the first time you were called a terrorist?
The first time I'm called a terrorist is definitely somewhere in 2015 or 2016. I want to say it was before the Dallas shootings that there were mumbling of us being terrorists, Black Lives Matter, both the leadership but also the organization being a terrorist organization. But it was definitely the Dallas shootings in which not just right-wing pundits but elected officials and appointed officials were calling us terrorists. And I think it was a moment where I saw my face and folks who I love faces and the headlines of Bill O'Reilly and the headlines of Breitbart News. Yes, I think that was the first time.
You mentioned Texas.
And specifically, you're talking about Micah Johnson, who at a Black Lives Matter protest ended up killing 5 police officers, who then responded by sending a robot to blow him up. When you woke up that morning and that was on the news.
I had just had my child just a few months before. I think I was 3 or 4 months out, and I remember first, before I got the news, because I was trying to stay away from the news and social media. I was supposed to be on maternity leave. I got a bunch of text messages, and they were like, did you see what happened in Dallas? Like, are you, like, we have to get an emergency phone call. And as I looked for folks of color, the first question we always ask about a shooter is, what race is he? Because it will determine the outcome of what happens to that person, but also what happens to us. And so the moment they said the shooter was Black, I was like, okay, like, they're about to go after us. And that's exactly what happened. And we spent the next 48 hours to 72 hours trying to navigate how to have a conversation about the state's need to blame any Black person's behavior, especially if it was against law enforcement, on Black Lives Matter.
And there's this thing that happens. I mean, we joke about it, though, in less serious situations, right? That when something happens, like, if you're Black, you're praying, or brown, you're praying, right? Mm-hmm. And praying that it's somebody else. Mm-hmm. But then there's this dynamic that happens with people of color, within certain pockets of people of color. But then this group trots themselves out and apologizes.
Yeah.
Right, for whatever that person has done on behalf of the race of people. But when Dylann Roof, right, murdered those folks, you never see white people trot people out and apologize for the brutality that they exercise on other people.
Yes. You are right, Kat. I think... you know, it was such an interesting moment. And for us, if the audience remembers, this was like the height of a resurgence of protesting because Philando and because Alton Sterling had just been murdered. And so the Dallas protests were for Philando and Alton Sterling. And the moment those officers were killed, it took a sharp left turn. And I think the work of BLM in that moment was to keep the momentum for our movement. And I think it was really important that we were able to say, this is our focus. Our folks are dying. We have to continue to pay attention to that. It's a tricky dynamic, I think, when you're constantly being blamed for harms against other people. And it's easy to fall into the trap of apologizing. And I think part of the work that we have to do is show up for what we know is true, which is Black folks are dying at the hands of law enforcement every single day. And just last year, 1,000 people died at the hands of the police, almost doubled from the year before. And today, 83 people, the month hasn't even ended yet, have been killed by law enforcement. We have to continue to have that conversation, even when it's in the spotlight and even when it's not.
Does that conversation shift or evolve when we are now in a dynamic of the Black Identity Extremist Report? Right. So for folks who don't know, but I imagine this is a room full of folks who do know, right, the FBI released a report called Black Identity Extremist, specifically about Black people that are doing work. And allegedly or perceive that there is danger to their lives by law enforcement. The whole report is filled with allegedly, perceived, perhaps, right? No concrete admission, of course, that there's a war on Black life. Does the conversation shift at all?
It does. I mean, I want to just say a few things about that. Number one is that the Black Identity Extremist label is made up by the FBI. It didn't exist before the FBI created it. So that should make everybody feel mad suspect. We're not out here with like black identity extremist hats and pens and t-shirts.
I'm about to get a shirt.
I know. I've seen the pens. I've seen the pens. But it happened after the FBI created it. And I just think that's important, right? They created a whole identity for black activists and black activism. And two, that there's always been a long history of black people who have fought for our freedom that have been labeled as terrorists, who are labeled as counterinsurgents. And I think with this black identity extremist label, we should see it in its historical context. And I think I'm curious about this moment because what we didn't have in the height of COINTELPRO is elected officials challenging the CIA publicly. What we do have in this moment is some elected officials, specifically Congresswoman Karen Bass, who has taken it the charge to hold Attorney General Jeff Sessions accountable, the FBI director, and really take them to task about this identity. And I think that's actually really important. And I think that's really necessary to have that conversation.
Listening to the voice of Patrice Cullors, co-founder of the organization Black Lives Matter, author of the new book, or co-author of the new book, When They Call You a Terrorist, a Black Lives Matter memoir. Her other writer is Asha Bendeli. On the stage with them is Kat Brooks from the Anti-Police Terror Network, and really getting to the heart of the matter, talking about when you were called a terrorist, the long history of black activists being criminalized and demonized, and the FBI with this new report about black identity extremists, and the tendency to blame anything and everyone on Black Lives Matter. This is not a new tactic. If you look through the annals of history and you go back to the late 60s and early 70s, anybody who was speaking out against injustice got the tag of being militant. That was the word that they used back then. Oh, you're a militant. You know, I just wanted the sidewalk in front of my house to be fixed. That's a militant, you know. And they had a war on drugs, which we later found out was concocted, and that there was no real danger of drugs, but it was an excuse to go after militant or people who were labeled militant by the Nixon administration. And, of course, on these airwaves, we did full shows on that. We've had people who are victims of that. Who are on the short end of the stick. We went into an in-depth discussion about that. So history is repeating itself, and on these airwaves, we like to remind people of that history so that we can have a better analysis and move forward as we combat the type of challenges that we are faced with. Let's listen to some more of Patrice Cullors here on Hard Knock Radio.
One of the things people might not know about you that I love it. Could have saved him for last. But because I think this idea of black identity extremists in particular, within the age of Trump and the war on dissent that he's waging, right? How does our organizing shift? Does it shift?
Yes, it does. And no, it doesn't. I think what's important is for us to understand that there's a long haul fight. And this particular moment, while we have to be responsive, we also can't get too wrapped up in reaction. I think what's been brilliant about the last 4.5 years is that we haven't gone anywhere. And the work has been ever more clear. I think the other piece is sometimes we get really caught up in sort of the national landscape when there's so much local work to be doing. When there's such a rich local fight. And in my opinion, and what we've seen historically, is the local really impacts the national. And if we can stay on the ground locally, if we could do that work, we could change the face of this country. We can look at... we can look at decriminalization. We can look at gay marriage, right, state by state, city by city, county by county, and eventually it spreads like wildfire across the country. So, my advice to organizers is always try to stay as local focused as possible with the clarity of a national and global lens.
Under the Obama administration, we saw a lot of reforms take place. We saw the Blue Ribbon Commission being formed. We saw body cameras. We saw the co-optation of the term community policing. We saw people talking about diversity in police departments. Can policing, from your perspective, be reformed?
No.
Why not?
I'm following your lead, facilitator. Flat out no. And I'm an abolitionist, a staunch abolitionist.
What does that mean for you?
I was just going to give that definition. we're like Zoom right now. So abolition is not just the getting rid of something. It's also the imagining of something else, the building of something else. And so abolition has a long history in this country, the abolition of slavery. Slavery was never really abolished. We could talk about the 13th Amendment. Policing, the court systems, jails and prisons, surveillance, is all in the prison police apparatus, and I believe that that should no longer exist. I think if we have policing, prisons, court surveillance, in any form or fashion, black people will always be suffering from it. We will always be bearing the brunt of those agencies. And so the work, I believe, is to abolish these systems. And then the other part of the work is to build institutions that are really the foundation around transformative justice, community accountability, and a deep desire for black folks to have our dignity, to be cared for in the ways that we deserve to be cared for. So this time especially, I think we should be calling for abolition. Under 45, it's easy because so much of what he's doing is egregious for us to sort of just to be like, all right, if we just get this, right, if we just get these small reforms, it's easy to sort of feel the hole of grief that we feel collectively because of this regime. But I think in these moments when it's heightened, right, that we should be calling for abolition, that we should be naming it, we should feel unapologetic in naming it, and we should be creating our local movements to mirror what abolition could look like locally. Part of what that looks like, I think, is requesting and demanding that we divest from law enforcement. I know that APTP and many Bay Area groups have made a call for divestment from Oakland OPD. I know that in Los Angeles we've made a call to divest from LAPD. And what we've seen is that in all of the social service budgets, and it's a tragedy that law enforcement is called a social service, but in all the social service budgets, law enforcement is the budget that's always increased. It's always given the most money. It's the most resourced. And everything else, access to employment, access to healthy food, access to adequate public education, is divested from. And so we need to flip that. And we have to be courageous enough to call for that. And our elected officials, who are often backing law enforcement, have to show up and say, okay, we cannot allow this to happen anymore.
But Patrice, what about crime?
Oh, so-called crime. Let's talk about it. I think there's different kinds of conversations we can have about harm and violence. I don't use the word crime. I know you don't either. You're just being a good questioner.
I was being a character.
I think we should always be talking about harm and violence and the ways in which we respond to it. I think the best organizers are not just talking about abolition without talking about accountability and community accountability. And some of the best work that I've seen it happening around this country. I've seen it happening in other places. Most of the communities that are marginalized don't actually call the police. I wasn't raised calling the police. In fact, in the book, I actually name a moment where I felt like I had to call the police. I did. They came, and then I asked them to leave. And I knew from that moment that, this calling the police actually isn't safe. And so we have to, it's imperative that we figure out other ways that we respond to harm and violence in our communities. I could spend a bit of time on that, but I want to stop there.
Okay. Mm-hmm. I'm going to unravel that just a little bit further. Mm-hmm. One of the things that I really, that really sat with me in the book as someone who comes from a family that was riddled with addiction, mm-hmm. Is your analysis around addiction and accountability. So there's the 12-step program, mm-hmm. right, which centers on personal accountability. Mm-hmm. But you have a larger frame that's sort of rooted in the conditions of community that I would love for you to expand upon.
Yeah, it's really the issue I have with personal responsibility is it makes it seem like our actions are in a vacuum. And so I think there's a difference between personal responsibility, which I disagree with that term, and personal accountability. I think we should all be accountable for actions or behavior, but being responsible is a different thing. And I think part of the work of looking at systems, especially a system that literally brought stolen people, brought them here to work on land, build up a place, and then didn't have a long-term plan for us. There was no long-term plan for black people. And as we fought for our freedom like we've been doing for 500 years, that has been grueling, it's been gruesome, it's been deeply traumatic. And so it is a human's natural response to cope with trauma. And part of coping with trauma is sometimes or often using substances. So that's one way to think about it. But there's another statistic that I think is very helpful, which is 80 to 90% of the people who use drugs don't ever become addicted to them. So then where did we come up with the idea that people, the moment you take a hit of something, you're going to become addicted? That is rhetoric from the war on drugs. That's a rhetoric that was created to demonize mostly black people. That was a rhetoric that was created to further this idea that black people didn't know how to take care of ourselves, didn't know how to manage ourselves. And it was an idea that furthered the criminalization of black people, right? We become addicted, become violent, out of control, you have to lock them up, you have to put them away. And so I really challenge the language around addiction. I try not to use that unless that's really true for somebody. And I really try to problematize, well, what's really going on? Is the drug use the problem, or is it the system that created the conditions for someone to use drugs the problem?
One of the things people might not know about you that I love and adore about you is your commitment to healing. Mm-hmm. So we have a question. My sister, mm-hmm. our people are feeling besieged by the real and psychological assault on our body and space. How can we respond and keep our sanity?
Yeah. I love that question.
I knew you would.
Yeah, so important. Well, a few things. I mean, I really deeply believe that a part of Black people's reparations package should be a therapist, each one of us. I'm going to say it enough that when we decide to go back to the reparations conversation, it's going to be like point one. And if you don't believe in talk therapy, some sort of healing modality, you know, something that you have access to on a daily basis, on a weekly basis. I'm a firm believer in therapy. I've been in it since I was 21 years old. And I deeply believe in community as a source of healing, being with friends, family, loved ones, spending a lot of time laughing. I deeply believe in courageous conversations, you know, as part of how we heal. It's never fun to have funkiness towards other folks and your movement. So I think that's another part of healing. And then there's like all the other things. I'm in California now, so y'all will get it. I was in other places, they were like, what? I like crystals and sage and... I build lots of altars everywhere I go. You know?
But how does a girl from the hood end up playing with crystals and sage?
I was always hella weird, though. Like, I was just the weird one, trust and believe. I would come out, my mom be like, oh, that's what you're wearing today. I had a, you know, a deep inspiration for me around spirit was Harriet Tubman. The earliest memories of reading about her was her visions that she would have. And I was like, ooh, I there's something in that that feels like it pulls me. So I always was like very clear about spirit. And, you know, in the book I talk about, I grew up Jehovah's Witness. And that was definitely not the religion that I wanted to be in as a child. It was very confusing. I didn't understand how the world had just been here for 2,000 years.
And you were like, what do you call it, exile?
I wasn't. My mother was.
Your mother was exiled?
Multiple times.
Because she had your brother at...
Because she had children out of wedlock.
Which means that she could go to the church, but she couldn't talk to anybody.
And people could not talk to her. And if they did, she had to tell them, I'm disfellowshipped. And they would say, okay, and back up. She was like a leper. It was very traumatic, actually, as a child. So I was like, why would I want to be a part of this? That don't make no sense. But I was like trying to find... I knew that I believed in spirit. And like, you know, no shade to the atheists in the house. I knew I believed in spirit, and I wanted what I loved about the Kingdom Hall was connection to something bigger than me, something broader than me, being in community. And so I really longed for that and eventually would find my spiritual home.
I've got a couple of questions with the same theme, so I'm going to go there, particularly about the work between the Latinx community and the Black community. I'm blending y'all's questions together. Mm-hmm. And dealing with anti-Blackness in Latinx community.
How do we deal with it?
And then move forward as mm-hmm. allies.
Yeah, well, you know, this is a good question, and I've answered a bit of this on the tour, which is like, how do we build relationships with each other? Sometimes we think that the way we build relationships with each other is like, do a project together, start a campaign together, which is true. That's a good way. Doing work together is a good way to be in relationship to one another. But there's all this time in between where we should be breaking bread together. We should be hanging out together. We should be getting to know each other. We should get to know our pet peeves. I mean, there's a way in which I deeply desire our work to feel like we're building family, and not just pounding to the concrete and doing work. Because that's when I know that someone has my back. I know when someone has my back because you've seen me ugly cry. You know, you've hung out with me and my baby. You've seen me vulnerable, not just on stage. There's a way in which I think we prioritize campaigns that are going to bring us together. And we've seen that that's... You know, what's love got to do with it? Like, we have to actually be building foundations with one another.
The other thing that folks might not know about you is that you are an accomplished artist.
Yeah.
And have been an artist most of your life.
Mm-hmm.
The role of art in the liberation movement.
It's everything. Black people are creative people. I think we are deeply connected to creativity and art, and so it weaves throughout everything that we do and every movement that we're a part of. And I often some of the best artists that I've met are organizers. And when I first joined the movement, I was 17 years old, and I remember one of my mentors saying to me, "You got to choose. It's either going to be this organizing or art." And I was like, nope.
We're about to do both of these things. And I'm so grateful that I was stubborn in that way, and that I said no, because I knew that I needed both. I needed both to fill. I couldn't be someone that was just in a conservatory and did art all day or theater all day. I would be very bored. And I can't. I'm not someone that just could be like strictly policy campaign work. I think it is important that we marry those things. And art and cultural work also gives us more space to feel and imagine how our world can be different. Sometimes when you get stuck in the rut of campaign and policy, you can't be imaginative. And I think art allows us to be imaginative.
There's this big push right now to go to the polls. It's like sort of the knee-jerk mm-hmm. reaction to Trump. BLM and electoral politics, mm-hmm. yes, no?
Sure. And that's not going to get us free.
Say more.
Well, okay, so it's a few things. For me, it's all about strategy. And for folks who've read Marx, it's time, place, and condition, right? What's the time, what's the place, what's the condition? The charge for electoral power is, I think it's an important charge. I don't think it's a charge that we should be neglectful of or not insert ourselves in. But if we steer ourselves, you know, the whole ship in that direction, we're going to lose a lot. And what I mean by that is the only good elected official is the elected official that is following the base, is following the people. And what I argue is that the right now are being really good elected officials to their base. Mm. They are showing up for their base. The Democratic Party that is supposed to be, we're supposed to be their base, has completely neglected us and have neglected us for a very long time. And so the conversation of electoral politics and where they're at right now, I think, is a fine place to start. But we actually need to go further. And the further is, we should be questioning why we live in a country that only has two parties. And we should be challenging ourselves in this moment to think about what it would look like to have more than two parties. What would it look like to have a party that's actually invested in Black people, and poor people, and workers. And so that's what I get curious about. Right now is an interesting moment. I'm not one of those people that's going to like sit and do a lot of criticizing of it. I think it's a good start. We need a multi-pronged strategy in order to like get to what we need and what we deserve.
Some of my Black and brown sisters felt the Women's March was a sellout, hijacked, I think that says bull. others embraced it. Your thoughts?
Oh, man. I have so many thoughts. So it's important in these moments that we look at history. And historically, what we've seen is Black folks are some of the first ones to fight for our freedom. And then we see usually white women fight for theirs. And it often doesn't look like an intersectional, holistic movement that it should look like. I think at this current moment, you know, when the call out for people to go march at Washington, that first call out was made by white women. And then there was an intervention made. I don't know the full story, but every creation story is important to understanding how we get to where we get. And there were women of color who were brought in to really intervene on that framework around whiteness. What I will say is the unfortunate reality is many of the women's marches across the country in particular, because I can't speak for the women's marches across the world, because there's been a lot in like third world countries. Brazil did a women's march, but many of the women's marches in this country have been largely led by white women who've relied on law enforcement to police their march. And literally is antithetical to the work that BLM has been doing and trying to do for the last 4 years. And so it becomes very complicated. And the National Women's March, I don't know if you saw, put out a letter basically to the public saying we are a decentralized movement, because they are, and I think if there were no Black Lives Matter, there would be no Women's March. We set the foundation. And the idea that this new new round of feminism is coming out of the Women's March is just false, because we are feminists and Black Lives Matter, and it's largely been led by Black women and queer people and trans people. And so this idea that white women get to own feminism, I think, is super disturbing. But they did write this letter, which basically they had to denounce many of the women's marches that were happening because they were relying on police. And so I think it's just important that we understand there are serious contradictions, and that I agree with some of the statement, right, that it's a hijack. But what it's important for me in these moments is to not let the hijack continue, that we get to take the narrative back. We get to remind people the story and what's been happening and why Black Lives Matter is a feminist movement. And actually, the resistance didn't start on November 6th when white women decided to wake up. That we've been here fighting for a very long time.
Black Lives Matter is a feminist movement. For some Black women, still, the word feminism can create that effect. Talk about for you what it means being a Black feminist, what Black feminism manifests as.
I don't generally identify as a feminist, although I am, for that very reason. But I guess what's important, and then I'll continue to answer your question, is I also don't want feminism to be allowed to be co-opted or relegated to white women. I think that's really dangerous. And my feminism is about centering those most at the margins, Black trans women in particular. My feminism is not just about equal pay, while I think equal pay is really important. And no, I'm not going to boycott Netflix for Monique, but I would help her wage a campaign against Netflix because I think it's important. I think feminism is challenging white supremacy, it's challenging patriarchy, and it's recreating a world where we imagine all genders, or no genders, to have deep autonomy and freedom.
Giving us a lot to think about. That was the voice of Patrice Cullors, co-author of the book, When They Call You a Terrorist, a Black Lives Matter memoir. Her and Asha Bendeli wrote this book. Then Patrice is at the First Congregational Church in Oakland with Kat Brooks, and really getting into some very important areas: the budgeting of police, addictions, do you call them or not, all sorts of things. And that's just the tip of the iceberg in this conversation with Kat Brooks and Patrice Cullors.
Talk, don't stop. EMN at it again. Sandman, that man. Chris Juwan Kim. Yeah. Innovation. Stimulating ill conversation. Anything else, you just imitation. Simulation. Step into the zone. The Bay Area zone. Hard Knock Radio. Let's go. Big shout out to Nita and Davey D. Yeah, right. Feel me. Yeah. Honing down at Hard Knock Radio.
Hard Knock Radio.
Kind of crazy, though. Oakland, stand up.
Yeah.
Stand up.
Ensemble Big Now Wolves.
Yeah.
Man.
Yeah.
Come on, y'all.
Why every novice think they hard knock when they ain't gone home in the name, faded calls for the fiend. Hating that they made they peace, trying to eat, killing any from the steel grave, beats and bees. Maybe they'll save you a seat at the table with a great bread, making a speech. Such a peace, little lovers I made with a beast. Made a stone shade on your name in the street.
Good girl.
Hey, Ricky and David G.
Real Talk Radio, you are now rocking with the best.
in the West, West Coast, Monday through Friday, East Coast.
Twilight of Empire. The Trump era, when it finally passes from the stage of history, will not pass either easily nor willingly. It will have left the aura of anxiety, the pangs of paranoia, and the air of enmity. It will be bitter, nasty, and mean, and it will not end with death. It will leave a stench of anger, of hatred, and sourness that will long dwell in the national unconscious, as well as the memory of the world. Such will be the legacy of Trump. Such will be the unworthy inheritance of the American empire. For the better part of a century, America played the role of protector of the weak and benefactor of the world's oppressed. But that was when the world was a bipolar one. The fall of the Soviet Union made the world unipolar, the world's sole superpower. And with that reality emerged the U.S. without a peer and without a mask. We saw then his true, angry, contemptuous face, snarling at the Third World, hostile to its European ancestors, and dismissive of Latin America. That's because an empire needs no allies, nor any friends. It needs subjects. It needs satraps. Where empires are political, economic, and military machines of dominance and exploitation. Its power is its only justification for being. It matters little whether Trump completes the full 8 years of two terms, or is there for the next 8 months. The die is cast. The empire has spat its utter contempt upon the world. The damage is done. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
What's up? This is Zion I.
This is Danny Glover.
Hi, I'm Margaret Cho.
Yo, what's up, Bay Area? You sitting here with Picasso of the Living Legends crew on Hard Knock Radio.
Hard Knock Radio.
Hard Knock Radio.
And you're listening to Hard Knock Radio.
Monday through Friday, and it's from 4 to 5 p.m. knocking hard in your area.
Free up your mind, y'all.
Here I go talking about the same thing. And then not as quick as you can fade away. It don't matter what I say if you want me to chain you to the sky. Oh my. And give me your kaleidoscope and monochrome. So unlike the way you're calling me at home. Some days it's so vivid, but mostly I would rather be blind. I'm not alright right now. I'm having trouble seeing you for what you do.
wallet in a basket and force me with your hand. My indignation goes beyond my neck. I'm not sure when you least expect, and whose final scene it is.
Hard Knock Radio, East, West, hard North, South, radio, conectados. Man. Every set, every hood, barrio to barrio. Y'all stand up, stay righteous, speaking to the thugs. One love, we know where y'all at. Hot Brown Buffalo. It's a hard knock life, gotta pay your bills. They want a song about bling, but it ain't real. We speak to the kids and the OGs. Organize, mobilize, be the change you wanna see. 415's bumping Hard Knock Radio. Brown Buffalo, all up in your stereo. And to the youth, live life like it's golden. Go dumb, go hard, but don't forget where you're going. We from the hood, so it's all to the good. Let us know this, what you're feeling is right. Let's get this understood. It's only one reason why we here today. We trying to make real music so the people can relate.
Learning from this hard knock, slipping in these hard knocks. Listening to hard knocks, questioning the hard knocks. Learning through these hard knocks, living for this hip hop. Listening to hard knocks, ripping to the hard side. Learning from the hard knocks, living in these hard knocks. Listening to hard knocks, questioning the hard knocks. Learning through these hard knocks, living for this hip hop. Listening to hard knocks, ripping to the hard side.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
You are listening to KBOO Portland. On April 7th, John Prine, the legendary American singer-songwriter, died at the age of 73 in Vanderbilt University Medical Center in Nashville, Tennessee. He was a victim of the coronavirus.